popular one. Some Western scientists, apparently consumed with guilt over having participated in the development of a weapon that could kill with new efficiency, took time out from their laboratories and studies to consider human affairs. They quickly came to conclusions expressed with an evangelical certainty they would never have used in discussing the physical world. Although he had done his greatest work in physics while a citizen of the sovereign nation of Switzerland, Einstein proved as immune to the Swiss example as everyone else. "As long as there are sovereign nations possessing great power," he declared, "war is inevitable." Fortunately, he and other scientists had managed to discover the one device that could solve the problem. Only the creation of a world government can prevent the impending self-destruction of mankind. World government seems like a straightforward extension of the logic of the Leviathan. If a national government with a monopoly on the use of force is the solution to the problem of homicide among individuals and of private and civil wars among factions, isn't a world government with a monopoly on the legitimate use of military force the solution to the problem of wars among nations? Most intellectuals did not go as far as Bertrand Russell, who in 1948 proposed that the Soviet Union should be given an ultimatum that unless it immediately submitted to world government, the United States would attack it with nuclear weapons. But world government was endorsed by, among others, Einstein, Wendell Willkie, Hubert Humphrey, Norman Cousins, Robert Maynard Hutchins, and William O. Douglas. Many people thought world government would gradually emerge out of the United Nations. Today, the campaign for world government lives on mainly among kooks and science fiction fans. One problem is that a functioning government relies on a degree of mutual trust and shared values among the people it governs, which is unlikely to exist across the entire globe. Another is that a world government would have no alternatives from which it could learn better governance, or to which its disgruntled citizens could emigrate, and hence it would have no natural checks against stagnation and arrogance. And the United Nations is unlikely to morph into a government that anyone would want to be governed by. The Security Council is hamstrung by the veto power that the great powers insisted on before ceding it any authority, and the General Assembly is more of a soapbox for despots than a parliament of the world's people. In Perpetual Peace, Kant envisioned a federation of free states that would fall well short of an international Leviathan. It would be a gradually expanding club of liberal republics rather than a global mega-government, and it would rely on the soft power of moral legitimacy rather than on a monopoly on the use of force. The modern equivalent is the Intergovernmental Organization, or IGO, a bureaucracy with a limited mandate to coordinate the policies of participating nations in some area in which they have a common interest. The international entity with the best track record for implementing world peace is probably not the United Nations, but the European Coal and Steel Community, an IGO founded in 1950 by France, West Germany, Belgium, the Netherlands, and Italy to oversee a common market and regulate the production of the two most important strategic commodities. The organization was specifically designed as a mechanism for submerging historic rivalries and ambitions, especially West Germany's, in a shared commercial enterprise. The coal and steel community set the stage for the European Economic Community, which in turn begot the European Union. Many historians believe that these organizations helped keep war out of the collective consciousness of Western Europe. By making national borders porous to people, money, goods, and ideas, they weakened the temptation of nations to fall into militant rivalries, just as the existence of the United States weakens any temptation of, say, Minnesota and Wisconsin to fall into a militant rivalry. By throwing nations into a club whose leaders had to socialize and work together, they enforced certain norms of cooperation. By serving as an impartial judge, they could mediate disputes among member nations. And by holding out the carrot of a vast market, they could entice applicants to give up their empires, in the case of Portugal, or to commit themselves to liberal democracy, in the case of former Soviet satellites, and perhaps soon, Turkey. Russet and O'Neill proposed that membership in intergovernmental organizations is the third vertex of a triangle of pacifying forces, which they attribute to Kant, the other two being democracy and trade. Though Kant did not single out trade and perpetual peace, he extolled it elsewhere, so Russet and O'Neill felt they could take some license in drawing their triangle. The international organizations needn't have utopian or even idealistic missions. They can coordinate defense, currency, postal service, tariffs, canal traffic, fishing rights, pollution, tourism, war crimes, weights and measures, road signs, anything, as long as they are voluntary associations of governments. Membership in these organizations steadily increased during the 20th century, with a bump after World War II. To verify whether IGO membership made an independent contribution to peace or just went along for the ride with democracy and trade, Russet and O'Neill counted the number of IGOs that every pair of nations jointly belonged to, and they threw it into the regression analysis together with the democracy and trade scores and the realpolitik variables. The researchers concluded that Kant got it right 3 out of 3 times. Democracy favors peace, trade favors peace, and membership in intergovernmental organizations favors peace. A pair of countries that are in the top tenth of the scale on all three variables are 83% less likely than an average pair of countries to have a militarized dispute in a given year, which means the likelihood is very close to zero. Might Kant have been right in an even grander sense? Russet and O'Neill defended the Kantian triangle with sophisticated correlations. But a causal story derived from correlational data is always vulnerable to the possibility that some hidden entity is the real cause of both the effect one is trying to explain and the variables one is using to explain it. In the case of the Kantian triangle, each putative pacifying agent may depend on a deeper and even more Kantian cause, a willingness to resolve conflicts by means that are acceptable to all the affected parties, rather than by the stronger party imposing its will on the weaker one. Nations become stable democracies only when their political factions tire of murder as the means of assigning power. They engage in commerce only when they put a greater value on mutual prosperity than on unilateral glory. And they join intergovernmental organizations only when they are willing to cede a bit of sovereignty for a bit of mutual benefit. In other words, by signing on to the Kantian variables, nations and their leaders are increasingly acting in such a way that the principle behind their actions can be made universal. Could the long peace represent the ascendancy in the international arena of the categorical imperative? Many scholars in international relations would snort at the very idea. According to an influential theory tendentiously called realism, the absence of a world government consigns nations to a permanent state of Hobbesian anarchy. That means that leaders must act like psychopaths and consider only the national self-interest, unsoftened by sentimental and suicidal thoughts of morality. Realism is sometimes defended as a consequence of the existence of human nature, where the underlying theory of human nature is that people are self-interested, rational animals. But as we shall see in chapters 8 and 9, humans are also moral animals, not in the sense that their behavior is moral in the light of disinterested ethical analysis, but in the sense that it is guided by moral intuitions, supported by emotions, norms, and taboos. Humans are also cognitive animals who spin out beliefs and use them to guide their actions. None of these endowments pushes our species toward peace by default, but it is neither sentimental nor unscientific to imagine that particular historical moments can engage the moral and cognitive faculties of leaders and their coalitions in a combination that inclines them toward peaceful coexistence. Perhaps the long peace is one of them. In addition to the three proximate Kantian causes, then, the long peace may depend on an ultimate Kantian cause. Norms among the influential constituencies in developed countries may have evolved to incorporate the conviction that war is inherently immoral because of its costs to human well-being, and that it can be justified only on the rare occasions when it is certain to prevent even greater costs to human well-being. If so, interstate war among developed countries would be going the way of customs such as slavery, serfdom, breaking on the wheel, disemboweling, bear-baiting, cat-burning, heretic-burning, witch-drowning, thief-hanging, public executions, the display of rotting corpses on gibbets, dueling, debtors' prisons, flogging, keel-hauling, and other practices that passed from unexceptionable to controversial to immoral to unthinkable to not thought about during the humanitarian revolution. Can we identify exogenous causes of the new humanitarian aversion to war among the developed countries? In Chapter 4, I conjectured that the humanitarian revolution was accelerated by publishing, literacy, travel, science, and other cosmopolitan forces that broaden people's intellectual and moral horizons. The second half of the 20th century has obvious parallels. It saw the dawn of television, computers, satellites, telecommunications, and jet travel, and an unprecedented expansion of science and higher education. The communications guru Marshall McLuhan called the post-war world a global village. In a village, the fortunes of other people are immediately felt. If the village is the natural size of our circle of sympathy, then perhaps when the village goes global, the villagers will experience greater concern for their fellow humans than when it embraced just the clan or tribe. A world in which a person can open the morning paper and meet the eyes of a naked, terrified little girl running toward him from a napalm attack 9,000 miles away is not a world in which a writer can opine that war is the foundation of all the high virtues and faculties of man, or that it enlarges the mind of a people and raises their character. The end of the Cold War and the peaceful dissolution of the Soviet Empire have also been linked to the easier movement of people and ideas at the end of the 20th century. By the 1970s and 1980s, the Soviet Union's attempt to retain its power by totalitarian control of media and travel was becoming a significant handicap. Not only was it becoming ludicrous for a modern economy to do without photocopiers, fax machines, and personal computers, to say nothing of the nascent internet, but it was impossible for the country's rulers to keep scientists and policy wonks from learning about ideas in the increasingly prosperous West, or to keep the post-war generation from learning about rock music, blue jeans, and other perquisites of personal freedom. Mikhail Gorbachev was a man of cosmopolitan tastes, and he installed in his administration many analysts who had traveled and studied in the West. The Soviet leadership made a verbal commitment to human rights in the 1975 Helsinki Accords, and a cross-border network of human rights activists were trying to get the populace to hold them to it. Gorbachev's policy of glasnost, openness, allowed Alexander Solzhenitsyn's The Gulag Archipelago to be serialized in 1989, and it allowed debates in the Congress of People's Deputies to be televised, exposing millions of Russians to the brutality of the past Soviet leadership and the ineptitude of the current one. Silicon chips, jet airplanes, and the electromagnetic spectrum were loosing ideas that helped to corrode the Iron Curtain. Though today's authoritarian China may seem to be straining the hypothesis that technology and travel are liberalizing forces, its leadership is incomparably less murderous than Mao's insular regime, as the numbers in the next chapter will show. There may be another reason why anti-war sentiments finally took. The trajectory of violent deaths in Europe is a craggy landscape in which three pinnacles, the wars of religion, the French Revolution, and Napoleonic Wars, and the two world wars, are followed by extended basins, each at a lower altitude than the preceding one. After each hemoclism, world leaders tried with some success to make a recurrence less likely. Of course, their treaties and concerts did not last forever, and an innumerate reading of history may invite the conclusion that the days of the long peace are running out and that an even bigger war is waiting to be born. But the Poisson pitter-patter of war shows no periodicity, no cycle of build-up and release. Nothing prevents the world from learning from its mistakes and driving the probability lower each time. Lars Erik Sederman went back to Kant's essays and discovered a twist in his prescription for perpetual peace. Kant was under no illusion that national leaders were sagacious enough to deduce the conditions of peace from first principles. He realized they would need to learn them from bitter historical experience. In an essay called Idea for a Universal History with a Cosmopolitan Purpose, he wrote, "Wars, tense and unremitting preparations, and the resultant distress which every state must eventually feel within itself, even in the midst of peace. These are the means by which nature drives nations to make initially imperfect attempts, but finally, after many devastations, upheavals, and even complete inner exhaustion of their powers, to take the step which reason could have suggested to them, even without so many sad experiences, that of abandoning their lawless state of savagery." Sederman suggests that Kant's theory of peace through learning should be combined with his theory of peace through democracy. Though all states, including democracies, start off warlike, since many democracies began as great powers, and all states can be blindsided by sudden terrible wars, democracies may be better equipped to learn from their catastrophes because of their openness to information and the accountability of their leaders. Sederman plotted the historical trajectory of militarized disputes from 1837 to 1992 within pairs of democracies and other pairs of countries. Democracies started out warlike and thereafter underwent periodic shocks that sent their rate of disputes skyward. But after each peak, their dispute rate quickly fell back to earth. Sederman also found that the learning curve was steeper for mature democracies than for newer ones. Autocracies, too, returned to more peaceable levels after the sudden shocks of major wars, but they did so more slowly and erratically. The fuzzy idea that after the 20th century hemoclism, an increasingly democratic world got tired of war and learned from its mistakes, may have some truth to it. A popular theme in the anti-war ballads of the 1960s was that evidence of the folly of war had always been available, but that people stubbornly refused to see it. How many deaths will it take till they learn that too many people have died? The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. Where have all the soldiers gone? Gone to graveyards, every one. When will they ever learn? After half a millennium of wars of dynasties, wars of religion, wars of sovereignty, wars of nationalism, and wars of ideology, of the many small wars in the spine of the distribution and a few horrendous ones in the tail, the data suggests that perhaps, at last, we're learning. Chapter 6. The New Peace. Macbeth's self-justifications were feeble, and his conscience devoured him. Yes, even Iago was a little lamb, too. The imagination and the spiritual strength of Shakespeare's evildoers stopped short at a dozen corpses, because they had no ideology. Alexander Solzhenitsyn. You would think that the disappearance of the gravest threat in the history of humanity would bring a sigh of relief among commentators on world affairs. Contrary to expert predictions, there was no invasion of Western Europe by Soviet tanks, no escalation of a crisis in Cuba or Berlin or the Middle East to a nuclear holocaust. The cities of the world were not vaporized, the atmosphere was not poisoned by radioactive fallout or choked with debris that blacked out the sun and sent Homo sapiens the way of the dinosaurs. Not only that, but a reunified Germany did not turn into a Fourth Reich, democracy did not go the way of monarchy, and the great powers and developed nations did not fall into a Third World War, but rather a long peace, which keeps getting longer. Surely the experts have been acknowledging the improvements in the world's fortunes from a few decades ago. But no, the pundits are glummer than ever. In 1989, John Gray foresaw a return to the classical terrain of history, a terrain of great power rivalries and irredentist claims and wars. A New York Times editor wrote in 2007, that this return had already taken place. It did not take long after 1989 for the gyre to wobble back onto its dependably blood-soaked course, pushed along by fresh gusts of ideological violence and absolutism. The political scientist Stanley Hoffman said that he had been discouraged from teaching his course on international relations because after the end of the Cold War, one heard about nothing but terrorism, suicide bombings, displaced people, and genocides. The pessimism is bipartisan. In 2007, the conservative writer Norman Podhoretz published a book called World War IV on the long struggle against Islamofascism, while the liberal columnist Frank Rich wrote that the world was a more dangerous place than ever. If Rich is correct, then the world was more dangerous in 2007 than it was during the two world wars, the Berlin crises of 1949 and 1961, the Cuban Missile Crisis, and all the wars in the Middle East. That's pretty dangerous. Why the gloom? Partly it's the result of market forces in the punditry business, which favor the Cassandras over the Pollyannas. Partly it arises from human temperament. As David Hume observed, the humor of blaming the present and admiring the past is strongly rooted in human nature and has an influence even on persons endowed with the profoundest judgment and most extensive learning. But mainly, I think, it comes from the innumeracy of our journalistic and intellectual culture. The journalist Michael Kinsley recently wrote, "It is a crushing disappointment that boomers entered adulthood with Americans killing and dying halfway around the world. And now, as boomers reach retirement and beyond, our country is doing the same damned thing." This assumes that 5,000 Americans dying is the same damned thing as 58,000 Americans dying, and that 100,000 Iraqis being killed is the same damned thing as several million Vietnamese being killed. If we don't keep an eye on the numbers, the programming policy, if it bleeds, it leads, will feed the cognitive shortcut. The more memorable, the more frequent, and we will end up with what has been called a false sense of insecurity. This chapter is about three kinds of organized violence that have stoked the new pessimism. They were given short shrift in the preceding chapter, which concentrated on wars among great powers and developed states. The long piece has not seen an end to these other kinds of conflict, leaving the impression that the world is a more dangerous place than ever. The first kind of organized violence embraces all the other categories of war, most notably the civil wars and wars between militias, guerrillas, and paramilitaries that plague the developing world. These are the new wars, or low-intensity conflicts, that are said to be fueled by ancient hatreds. Familiar images of African teenagers with Kalashnikovs support the impression that the global burden of war has not declined, but has only been displaced from the northern to the southern hemisphere. The new wars are thought to be especially destructive to civilians because of the hunger and disease they leave in their wake, which are omitted from most counts of war dead. According to a widely repeated statistic, at the beginning of the 20th century, 90% of war deaths were suffered by soldiers and 10% by civilians. But by the end of the century, these proportions had reversed. Horrifying estimates of fatalities from famines and epidemics, rivaling the death toll of the Nazi Holocaust, have been reported in war-torn countries such as the Democratic Republic of the Congo. The second kind of organized violence I will track is the mass killing of ethnic and political groups. The 100-year period from which we have recently escaped has been called the Age of Genocide and a Century of Genocide. Many commentators have written that ethnic cleansing emerged with modernity, was held at bay by the hegemony of the superpowers, returned with a vengeance with the end of the Cold War, and today is as prevalent as ever. The third is terrorism. Since the September 11, 2001 attacks on the United States, the fear of terrorism has led to a massive new bureaucracy, two foreign wars, and obsessive discussion in the political arena. The threat of terrorism is said to pose an existential threat to the United States, having the capacity to do away with our way of life or to end civilization itself. Each of these scourges, of course, continues to take a toll in human lives. The question I will ask in this chapter is exactly how big a toll, and whether it has increased or decreased in the past few decades. It's only recently that political scientists have tried to measure these kinds of destruction, and now that they have reached a surprising conclusion. All these kinds of killing are in decline. The decreases are recent enough. In the past 2 decades or less, that we cannot count on them lasting. And in recognition of their tentative nature, I will call this development the new peace. Nonetheless, the trends are genuine declines of violence and deserve our careful attention. They are substantial in size, opposite in sign to the conventional wisdom, and suggestive of ways we might identify what went right and do more of it in the future. The trajectory of war in the rest of the world. What was the rest of the world doing during the 600 years when the great powers and European states went through their ages of dynasties, religions, sovereignty, nationalism, and ideology, were racked by 2 world wars and then fell into a long peace? Unfortunately, the Eurocentric bias of the historical record makes it impossible to trace out curves with any confidence. Before the advent of colonialism, large swaths of Africa, the Americas, and Asia were host to predation, feuding, and slave raiding that slunk beneath the military horizon or fell in the forest without any historian hearing them. Colonialism itself was implemented in many imperial wars that the great powers waged to acquire their colonies, suppress revolts, and fend off rivals. Throughout this era, there were plenty of wars. For the period from 1400 through 1938, Breck's conflict catalog lists 276 violent conflicts in the Americas, 283 in North Africa and the Middle East, 586 in sub-Saharan Africa, 313 in Central and South Asia, and 657 in East and Southeast Asia. Historical myopia prevents us from plotting trustworthy trends in the frequency or deadliness of the wars, but we saw in the preceding chapter that many were devastating. They included civil and interstate wars that were proportionally, and in some cases absolutely, more lethal than anything taking place in Europe, such as the American Civil War, the Taiping Rebellion in China, the War of the Triple Alliance in South America, and the conquests of Shaka Zulu in southern Africa. In 1946, just when Europe, the great powers, and the developed world started racking up their peaceful zeros, the historical record for the world as a whole snaps into focus. That is the first year covered in a meticulous data set compiled by Bethany Licinia, Nils Petter Gleditsch, and their colleagues at the Peace Research Institute of Oslo, called the PRIO Battle Deaths data set. The dataset includes every known armed conflict that killed as few as 25 people in a year. The conflicts that rise to the level of 1,000 deaths a year are promoted to wars, matching the definition used in the Correlates of War Project, but they are otherwise given no special treatment. I will continue to use the word war in its non-technical sense to refer to armed conflicts of all sizes. The PRIO researchers aim for criteria that are as reliable as possible, so that analysts can compare regions of the world and plot trends over time using a fixed yardstick. Without strict criteria, when analysts use direct battlefield deaths for some wars, but include indirect deaths from epidemics and famines in others, or when they count army against army wars in some regions but throw in genocides in others, comparisons are meaningless and are too easily used as propaganda for one cause or another. The PRIO analysts comb through histories, media stories, and reports from government and human rights organizations to tally deaths from war as objectively as possible. The counts are conservative. Indeed, they are certainly underestimates, because they omit all deaths that are merely conjectured or whose causes cannot be ascertained with confidence. Similar criteria and overlapping data are used in other conflict data sets, including those of the Uppsala Conflict Data Project, UCDP, whose data begin in 1989, the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, SIPRI, which uses adjusted UCDP data, and the Human Security Report Project, HSRP, which draws on both the PRIO and UCDP's datasets. Like Lewis Richardson, the new conflict counters have to deal with failures of thingness, and so they divide the conflicts into categories using obsessive-compulsive criteria. The first cut distinguishes three kinds of mass violence that vary in their causes and, just as importantly, in their countability. The concept of war and its milder version, armed conflict, applies most naturally to multiple killing that is organized and socially legitimated. That invites a definition in which a war must have a government on at least one side, and the two sides must be contesting some identifiable resource, usually a territory or the machinery of government. To make this clear, the datasets call wars in this narrow sense state-based armed conflicts, and they are the only conflicts for which data go all the way back to 1946. The second category embraces non-state or intercommunal conflict, and it pits warlords, militias, or paramilitaries, often aligned with ethnic or religious groups, against each other. The third category has the clinical name one-sided violence and embraces genocides, politicides, and other massacres of unarmed civilians, whether perpetrated by governments or by militias. The exclusion of one-sided violence from the PRIO dataset is in part a tactical choice to divide violence into categories with different causes. But it is also a legacy of historians' long-standing fascination with war at the expense of genocide, which only recently has been recognized as more destructive of human life. Rudolf Rummel, the political scientist Barbara Harf, and the UCDP have collected datasets of genocides, which we will examine in the next section. The first of the three categories, state-based conflicts, is then subdivided according to whom the government is fighting. The prototypical war is the interstate war, which pits two states against each other, such as the Iran-Iraq War of 1980 through 88. Then there are extra-state or extra-systemic wars, in which a government wages war on an entity outside its borders that is not a recognized state. These are generally imperial wars, in which a state fights indigenous forces to acquire a colony, or colonial wars, in which it fights to retain one, such as France and Algeria from 1954 to 1962. Finally, there are civil or intrastate wars, in which the government fights an insurrection, rebellion, or secessionist movement. These are further subdivided into civil wars that are completely internal, such as the recently concluded war in Sri Lanka between the government and the Tamil Tigers, and the internationalized intrastate wars, in which a foreign army intervenes, usually to help a government defend itself against the rebels. The wars in Afghanistan and Iraq both began as interstate conflicts, the United States and its allies against Taliban-controlled Afghanistan, and the United States and its allies against Ba'athist-controlled Iraq. But as soon as the governments were toppled and the invading armies remained in the country to support the new governments against insurgencies, the conflicts were reclassified as internationalized intrastate conflicts. Now there's the question of which deaths to count. The PRIO and UCDP datasets tally directly, or battle-related deaths, the people who are shot, stabbed, clubbed, gassed, blown up, drowned, or deliberately starved, as part of a contest in which the perpetrators themselves have to worry about getting hurt. The victims may be soldiers, or they may be civilians who were caught in the crossfire or killed in collateral damage. The battle-related death statistics exclude indirect deaths arising from disease, starvation, stress, and the breakdown of infrastructure. When indirect deaths are added to direct deaths to yield the entire toll attributable to the war, the sum may be called excess deaths. Why do the datasets exclude indirect deaths? It's not to write these kinds of suffering out of the history books, but because direct deaths are the only ones that can be counted with confidence. Direct deaths also conform to our basic intuition of what it means for an agent to be responsible for an effect that it causes. Namely, that the agent foresees the effect, intends for it to happen, and makes it happen via a chain of events that does not have too many uncontrollable intervening links. The problem with estimating indirect deaths is that it requires us to undertake the philosophical exercise of simulating in our imagination the possible world in which the war didn't occur, and estimating the number of deaths that took place in that world, which is then used as a baseline. And that requires something close to omniscience. Would a post-war famine have taken place even if the war had not broken out because of the ineptitude of the overthrown government? What if there was a drought that year? Should the famine deaths be blamed on the war or on the weather? If the rate of death from hunger was going down in the years before a war, should we assume that it would have declined even further if the war hadn't occurred, or should we freeze it at its level in the last year before the war? If Saddam Hussein had not been deposed, would he have gone on to kill more political enemies than the number of people who died in the intercommunal violence following his defeat? Should we add the 40 to 50 million victims of the 1918 influenza pandemic to the 15 million who were killed in World War I because the flu virus would not have evolved its virulence if the war hadn't packed so many troops into trenches? Estimating indirect deaths requires answering these sorts of questions in a consistent way for hundreds of conflicts, an impossible undertaking. Wars in general tend to be destructive in many ways at once, and the ones that kill more people on the battlefield also generally lead to more deaths from famine, disease, and the disruption of services. To the extent that they do, trends in battle deaths can serve as a proxy for trends in overall destructiveness. But they don't in every case. And later in the chapter, we will ask whether developing nations, with their fragile infrastructure, are more vulnerable to knock-on effects than advanced nations, and whether this ratio has changed over time, making battle deaths a misleading index of trends in the human toll of conflict. Now that we have the precision instrument of conflict data sets, what do they tell us about the recent trajectory of war in the entire world? Let's begin with the bird's-eye view of the rate of battle deaths in state-based armed conflicts, 1900 through 2005. This data was compiled by Lesina, Gleditsch, and Russet, who retrofitted numbers from the Correlates of War Project from 1900 to 1945 to the PRIO data set from 1946 to 2005, and divided the numbers by the size of the world's population to yield an individual's risk of dying in battle over the century. Plotted on a graph, these numbers remind us of the freakish destructiveness of the two world wars. They were not steps on a staircase or swings of a pendulum, but massive spikes poking through a bumpy lowland. The drop-off in the rate of battle deaths after the early 1940s, peaking at 300 per 100,000 people per year, has been precipitous. The world has seen nothing close to that level since. Now let's zero in on the period following the Second World War, 1946 through 2008. Even after we have lopped off the massive ski jump from World War II, no one can miss another steep falloff in the rate of getting killed in battle that has taken place over the past 60 years. This period, even with 31 ongoing conflicts in that mid-decade, including Iraq, Afghanistan, Chad, Sri Lanka, and Sudan, enjoyed an astoundingly low rate of battle deaths, around 0.5 per 100,000 per year, falling below the homicide rate of even the world's most peaceable societies. The figures, granted, are lowballs, since they include only reported battle deaths, but that is true for the entire time series. And even if we were to multiply the recent figures by 5, they would sit well below the world's overall homicide rate of 8.8 per 100,000 per year. In absolute numbers, annual battle deaths have fallen by more than 90%, from around 500,000 per year in the late 1940s to around 30,000 a year in the early 2000s. So believe it or not, from a global, historical, and quantitative perspective, the dream of the 1960s folk songs has come true. The world has almost put an end to war. Let's take our jaws off the table and look more closely at what happened in four categories. First, the extra-state colonial war category, a kind of war that has vanished off the face of the earth. Wars in which a great power tried to hang on to a colony could be extremely destructive, such as France's attempts to retain Vietnam between 1946 and 1954, 375,000 battle deaths, and Algeria between 1954 and 1962, 182,500 battle deaths. After what has been called the greatest transfer of power in world history, this kind of war no longer exists. The second category is wars between states. This includes the Korean War from 1950 to 1953, 1 million battle deaths spread over 4 years, the Vietnam War from 1962 through 1975, 1.6 million battle deaths spread over 14 years, and the Iran-Iraq War, 645,000 battle deaths spread over 9 years. Since the end of the Cold War, there have been only two significant interstate wars, the First Gulf War, with 23,000 battle deaths, and the 1998 through 2000 war between Eritrea and Ethiopia, with 50,000. By the first decade of the new millennium, interstate wars had become few in number, mostly brief, and relatively low in battle deaths. India-Pakistan and Eritrea-Djibouti, neither of which counts as a war in the technical sense of having 1,000 deaths a year, and the quick overthrow of the regimes in Afghanistan and Iraq. In 2004, 2005, 2006, 2007, and 2009, there were no interstate conflicts at all. The long peace, an avoidance of major war among great powers and developed states, is spreading to the rest of the world. Aspiring great powers no longer feel the need to establish their greatness by acquiring an empire or picking on weaker countries. China boasts of its peaceful rise and Turkey of a policy it calls zero problems with neighbors. Brazil's foreign minister recently crowed, "I don't think there are many countries that can boast that they have 10 neighbors and haven't had a war in the last 140 years. And East Asia seems to be catching Europe's distaste for war. Though in the decades after World War II, it was the world's bloodiest region, with ruinous wars in China, Korea, and Indochina from 1980 to 1993. The number of conflicts and their toll in battle deaths plummeted, and they have remained at historically unprecedented lows ever since. As interstate war was being snuffed out, though, civil wars, Category 3, began to flare up. The first and greatest, the 1.2 million battle deaths in the 1946 through 50 Chinese Civil War, another period of civil war in the 1980s, which contains the 435,000 battle deaths in the Soviet Union-bolstered civil war in Afghanistan. And snaking its way through the 1980s and 1990s, we find a continuation of a mass of smaller civil wars in countries such as Angola, Bosnia, Chechnya, Croatia, El Salvador, Ethiopia, Guatemala, Iraq, Liberia, Mozambique, Somalia, Sudan, Tajikistan, and Uganda, though even these decrease in the 2000s. To get a clearer picture of what the numbers here are telling us, it helps to disaggregate the death tolls into two main dimensions of war: how many there were, and how lethal each kind was. As colonial wars disappeared and interstate wars were petering out, internationalized civil wars vanished for a brief instant at the end of the Cold War, when the Soviet Union and the United States stopped supporting their client states, and then reappeared with the policing wars in Yugoslavia, Afghanistan, Iraq, and elsewhere. But the big news was an explosion in the number of purely internal civil wars that began around 1960, peaked in the early 1990s, and then declined through 2003, followed by a slight bounce. More than half of the 9.4 million battle deaths in the 260 conflicts between 1946 and 2008 come from just five wars, three of them between states: Korea, Vietnam, Iran-Iraq, and the two within states, China and Afghanistan. Most of the downward trend in the death toll came from the fact there were fewer of the really destructive wars. In addition to the differences in the contributions of wars of different sizes to the overall death tolls, there are substantial differences in the contributions of the wars of different kinds. Until recently, the most lethal kind of war by far was the interstate war. There is nothing like a pair of leviathans amassing cannon fodder, lobbing artillery shells, and pulverizing each other's cities to rack up truly impressive body counts. A distant second and third are the wars in which a leviathan projects its might in some other part of the world to prop up a beleaguered government or keep a grip on its colonies. Pulling up the rear are the internal civil wars, which, at least since the Chinese slaughterhouse in the late 1940s, have been far less deadly. When a gang of Kalashnikov-toting rebels harasses the government in a small country that the great powers don't care about, the damage they do is more limited. And even these fatality rates have decreased over the past quarter century. In 1950, the average armed conflict of any kind killed 33,000 people. In 2007, it killed less than 1,000. How can we make sense of the juddering trajectory of conflict since the end of World War II, easing into the lull of the new peace? One major change has been in the theater of armed conflict. Wars today take place mainly in poor countries, mostly in an arc that extends from Central and East Africa through the Middle East, across Southwest Asia and Northern India, and down into Southeast Asia. About half of the conflicts take place in the countries with the poorest sixth of the people. In the decades before 2000, conflicts were scattered in other poor parts of the world as well, such as Central America and West Africa. Neither the economic nor the geographic linkage with war is a constant of history. Recall that for half a millennium, the wealthy countries of Europe were constantly at each other's throats. The relationship between poverty and war in the world today is smooth but highly nonlinear. Among wealthy countries in the developed world, the risk of civil war is essentially zero. For countries with a per capita gross domestic product of around $1,500 a year, in 2003 U.S. dollars, the probability of a new conflict breaking out within 5 years rises to around 3%. But from there downward, the risk shoots up. For countries with a per capita GDP of $750, it is 6%. For countries whose people earn $500, it is 8%. And for those that subsist on $250, it is 15%. A simplistic interpretation of the correlation is that poverty causes war because poor people have to fight for survival over a meager pool of resources. Though undoubtedly some conflicts are fought over access to water or arable land, the connection is far more tangled than that. For starters, the causal arrow also goes in the other direction. War causes poverty because it's hard to generate wealth when roads, factories, and granaries are blown up as fast as they are built, and when the most skilled workers and managers are constantly being driven from their workplaces or shot. War has been called development in reverse, and the economist Paul Collier has estimated that a typical civil war costs the afflicted country $50 billion. Also, neither wealth nor peace comes from having valuable stuff in the ground. Many poor and war-torn African countries are overflowing with gold, oil, diamonds, and strategic metals, while affluent and peaceable countries such as Belgium, Singapore, and Hong Kong have no natural resources to speak of. There must be a third variable, presumably the norms and skills of a civilized trading society, that causes both wealth and peace. And even if poverty does cause conflict, it may do so not because of competition over scarce resources, but because the most important thing that a little wealth buys a country is an effective police force and army to keep domestic peace. The fruits of economic development flow far more to a government than to a guerrilla force, and that is one of the reasons that the economic tigers of the developing world have come to enjoy a state of relative tranquility. Whatever effects poverty may have, measures of it and of other structural variables like the youth and maleness of a country's demographics change too slowly to fully explain the recent rise and fall of civil war in the developing world. Their effects, though, interact with the country's form of governance. The thickening of the civil war wedge in the 1960s had an obvious trigger, decolonization. European governments may have brutalized the natives when conquering a colony and putting down revolts, but they generally had a fairly well-functioning police, judiciary, and public service infrastructure. And while they often had their pet ethnic groups, their main concern was controlling the colony as a whole. So they enforced law and order fairly broadly and, in general, did not let one group brutalize another with too much impunity. When the colonial governments departed, they took competent governance with them. A similar semi-anarchy burst out in parts of Central Asia and the Balkans in the 1990s, when the communist federations that had ruled them for decades suddenly unraveled. One Bosnian Croat explained why ethnic violence erupted only after the breakup of Yugoslavia. "We lived in peace and harmony because every 100 meters we had a policeman to make sure we loved each other very much." Many of the governments of the newly independent colonies were run by strongmen, kleptocrats, and the occasional psychotic. They left large parts of their countries in anarchy, inviting the predation and gang warfare we saw in Polly Weissner's account of the decivilizing process in New Guinea in Chapter 3. They siphoned tax revenue to themselves and their clans, and their autocracies left the frozen-out groups no hope for change except by coup or insurrection. They responded erratically to minor disorders, letting them build up and then sending death squads to brutalize entire villages, which only inflamed the opposition further. Perhaps an emblem for the era was John Bedel Bokassa of the Central African Empire, the name he gave to the small country formerly called the Central African Republic. Bokassa had 17 wives, personally carved up, and according to rumors, occasionally ate his political enemies, had school children beaten to death when they protested expensive mandatory uniforms bearing his likeness, and crowned himself emperor in a ceremony complete with a gold throne and diamond-studded crown that cost one of the world's poorest countries a third of its annual revenue. During the Cold War, many tyrants stayed in office with the blessing of the great powers, who followed the reasoning of Franklin Roosevelt about Nicaragua's Anastasio Somoza: "He may be a son of a bitch, but he's our son of a bitch." The Soviet Union was sympathetic to any regime it saw as advancing the worldwide communist revolution, and the United States was sympathetic to any regime that kept itself out of the Soviet orbit. Other great powers, such as France, tried to stay on the good side of any regime that would supply them with oil and minerals. The autocrats were armed and financed by one superpower, insurrectionists who fought them were armed by the other, and both patrons were more interested in seeing their client win than in seeing the conflict come to an end. There was a second expansion of civil wars around 1975, when Portugal dismantled its colonial empire, and the American defeat in Vietnam emboldened insurrectionists elsewhere in the world. The number of civil wars peaked at 51 in 1991, which, not coincidentally, is the year the Soviet Union went out of existence, taking the Cold War-stoked proxy conflicts with it. Only a fifth of the decline in conflicts, though, can be attributed to the disappearance of proxy wars. The end of communism removed another source of fuel to world conflict. It was the last of the anti-humanist, struggle-glorifying creeds in Luard's Age of Ideologies. We'll look at a new one, Islamism, later in this chapter. Ideologies, whether religious or political, push wars out along the tail of the deadliness distribution, because they inflame leaders into trying to outlast their adversaries in destructive wars of attrition, regardless of the human costs. The three deadliest post-war conflicts were fueled by Chinese, Korean, and Vietnamese communist regimes that had a fanatical dedication to outlasting their opponents. Mao Zedong, in particular, was not embarrassed to say that the lives of his citizens meant nothing to him. "We have so many people, we can afford to lose a few. What difference does it make?" On one occasion, he quantified a few, 300 million people, or half the country's population at the time. He also stated that he was willing to take an equivalent proportion of humanity with him in the cause. If the worst came to the worst, and half of mankind died, the other half would remain, while imperialism would be razed to the ground and the whole world would become socialist. As for China's erstwhile comrades in Vietnam, much has been written, often by the chastened decision-makers themselves, about the American miscalculations in that war. The most fateful was their underestimation of the ability of the North Vietnamese and Viet Cong to absorb casualties. As the war unfolded, American strategists like Dean Rusk and Robert McNamara were incredulous that a backward country like North Vietnam could resist the most powerful army on earth, and they were always confident that the next escalation would force it to capitulate. As John Mueller notes, if battle death rate as a percentage of pre-war population is calculated for each of the hundreds of countries that have participated in international and colonial wars since 1816, it is apparent that Vietnam was an extreme case. The communist side accepted battle death rates that were about twice as high as those accepted by the fanatical, often suicidal, Japanese in World War II, for example. Furthermore, the few combatant countries that did experience loss rates as high as that of the Vietnamese communists were mainly those such as the Germans and Soviets in World War II, who were fighting to the death for their national existence, not for expansion like the North Vietnamese. In Vietnam, it seems, the United States was up against an incredibly well-functioning organization, patient, firmly disciplined, tenaciously led, and largely free from corruption or enervating self-indulgence. Although the communists often experienced massive military setbacks and periods of stress and exhaustion, they were always able to refit themselves, rearm, and come back for more. It may well be, as one American general put it, they were in fact the best enemy we have faced in our history. Ho Chi Minh was correct when he prophesied, "Kill 10 of our men, and we will kill one of yours. In the end, it is you who will tire." The American democracy was willing to sacrifice a tiny fraction of the lives that the North Vietnamese dictator was willing to forfeit. No one asked the proverbial 10 men how they felt about this, and the United States eventually conceded the war of attrition, despite having every other advantage. But by the 1980s, as China and Vietnam were changing from ideological to commercial states and easing their reins of terror over their populations, they were less willing to inflict comparable losses in unnecessary wars. A world that is less invigorated by honor, glory, and ideology, and more tempted by the pleasures of bourgeois life, is a world in which fewer people are killed. After Georgia lost a 5-day war with Russia in 2008, over control of the tiny territories of Abkhazia and South Ossetia, Georgia's president, Mikhail Saakashvili, explained to a New York Times writer why he decided not to organize an insurgency against the occupation. "We had a choice here. We could turn this country into Chechnya. We had enough people and equipment to do that. Or we had to do nothing and stay a modern European country. Eventually, we would have chased them away, but we would have had to go to the mountains and grow beards. That would have been a tremendous national, philosophical, and emotional burden." The explanation was melodramatic, even disingenuous. Russia had no intention of occupying Georgia, but it does capture one of the choices in the developing world that lies behind the new peace. Go to the mountains and grow beards, or do nothing and stay a modern country. Other than the end of the Cold War and the decline of ideology, what led to the mild reduction in the number of civil wars during the past 2 decades, and the steep reduction in battle deaths of the last one? And why do conflicts persist in the developing world, 36 in 2008, all but one of them civil wars, when they have essentially disappeared in the developed world? A good place to start is the Kantian triangle of democracy, open economies, and engagement with the international community. Russet and O'Neill's statistical analyses, described in the preceding chapter, embrace the entire world, but they include only disputes between states. How well does the triad of pacifying factors apply to civil wars within developing countries, where most of today's conflicts take place?